The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Gabriel Sherman. Now, Gabriel is an author. He's written for a bunch of places, a bunch of great places. But for the purposes of this show, we're not going to be talking about his journalism, but his work in the film industry, the screenwriter of, among other things, Independence Day Resurgence. Maybe we can talk about that for a minute. But the reason we're here today is to talk about The Apprentice, the new controversial movie about Donald Trump and Roy Cohn and their relationship. Gabe, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So we are going to talk a little bit about the controversy of getting this movie released, getting it distributed, the response at festivals, that sort of thing. But first, let's just start at the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. How did you get involved with this project? Did you sit down and write a spec? Did somebody come to you? What was the process there like?
So yes, as you mentioned at the top, I do journalism, and really the inspiration for this movie came out of my journalism. I covered Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign for New York Magazine, and I was struck during the campaign that people like Roger Stone and others who had known Trump since the 80s told me things like, you know, he sounds a lot like Roy Cohn, or he's using the lessons that Roy Cohn taught him. And that was came to me in a flash. You know, I really put two and two together and I thought, shit, there's like a compelling movie that explores this one relationship. You know, it's sort of a Frankenstein story of how Roy Cohn created his apprentice, Donald Trump. So I wrote a treatment and showed it to my agent. He thought it was a good idea. And we went out to the town with it, showed it to some producers. The first, you know, that we showed it to, the first few that we showed it to had, you know, said, great idea, but no one's going to make a Donald Trump movie. But I eventually sold the idea to Amy Baer, a longtime Sony Pictures and other studio executive. She, you know, 25, 30 year career in Hollywood. She now runs her own development company, and she commissioned the script based on my idea.
When you say people said no one's going to make a Donald Trump movie, what was the reasoning there? Was it a, you know, we don't think nobody's going to make this because it can't make money. Nobody's going to make this because we don't want to run the risk of offending people. Nobody's going to make this because we don't want to run the risk of lionizing him. What's the impetus there for that rejection out of hand?
Well, you know, let's go back in time. This was in 2017, summer of 2017, fall of 17. So we were, you know, in the first months of the Trump presidency. And, you know, I think the entire industry was, you know, shell-shocked, you know, A, that he won. And B, you know, they saw the way he attacked adversaries on Twitter. And I think Hollywood executives, the last thing they want to do is, you know, to be called out and be a target from his angry MAGA base. So I, you know, I didn't get a specific reason why, you know, we didn't get any traction with the first people we approached for this. But I have to imagine that, you know, that they were, they just didn't want to get into the mud of, you know, doing a project about Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's funny. 2017 to 2024, that should give folks some idea of the average gestational period for a movie of this sort. I mean, we're talking, you know, 7-8 years here.
It's as old as my daughter is seven. And so I can measure the length of time it took to make this movie based on, you know, her growth chart. You know, the little marks on the wall are like the marks of how long it took to make the film. But, you know, as you point out, the gears of Hollywood do turn slowly. I mean, it's not just this movie that takes years to get off the ground, but, you know, this one in particular faced extra challenges.
Yeah. Let's go a step further back. Let's talk about Roy Cohn and who he was and what he meant to Donald Trump, because that is one of the interesting things about this movie is I frankly don't know a lot about Roy Cohn outside of what I read in the process of reading stories about Donald Trump over the years. You know, he's I think a little before a lot of our times, but he is a key kind of pivotal figure in 1950s through 1980s, conservatism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, Roy Cohn's shadow looms over, you know, really the second half of the 20th century and even the first quarter of the 21st century, given his influence. He was, as you point out, a lawyer. He grew up in New York City. His father was a very prominent Bronx judge. His mother came from a very prominent and wealthy Jewish banking family that lost all of their money during the Depression. Her parents' bank failed, and so, you know, she came from a prominent family, but, you know, they had lost a lot of her money by the time Roy was born. And, you know, Roy Cohn was a wunderkind lawyer. I mean, I think for all of his controversy, you know, it sometimes gets overlooked about how brilliant he was. He graduated Columbia Law School at about 19. He was a young federal prosecutor who was assigned to prosecute the Julius and Ethel Rosenberg atomic spy case, which infamously sent both of them to the electric chair. And it really helped to kick off the communist Red Scare of the 1950s. And from there, he made his way to Washington and became the, you know, the lead attorney for Senator Joseph McCarthy's televised Senate trials, where they dragged all sorts of public officials and prominent people in front of the cameras and asked them about their communist affiliations. And, you know, it created this, you know, kind of us versus them, you know, paranoia that, you know, really infected the culture from the 1950s on. And so, you know, that was Roy Cohn's rise, but he had an ignominious fall because he kind of overreached, and he did a favor to help get his friend, which many people believed and was rumored to be his lover, special treatment, which led to him getting forced out of the Justice Department. And he moved back to New York City, and starting in the 1960s and until the time he met Donald Trump in 1973, Roy Cohn reinvented himself as a fixer and a power broker and a lawyer to Manhattan society. He represented business people, mob bosses, media figures. He, you know, quote unquote, dated Barbara Walters for a time to sort of help hide his closeted homosexuality. So he was just a larger than life figure, but he really helped to shape the hard edged, you know, right wing anti-communist style of politics that was so pervasive in the second half of the 20th century. And that was the set of tools that Donald Trump got to learn when he met Roy Cohn in 1973.
So in the movie, we meet Cohn the same time that Trump meets Cohn in 1973. There's this great shot in the movie of him kind of looking across this red and black, you know, dining room, very, very devilish, very, you know, very here's Mephisto in the background kind of making his moves and keeping an eye on his potential targets. And it's but we don't get a lot of that stuff that you just talked about in terms of watching his rise, rise and then fall. Was there an earlier version of the script that kind of broke that down more? Did you always start we're starting here?
Yeah, no, the movie always began in 1973 and it ended, spoiler alert, with Roy Cohn's death in 1986. I thought all of Roy's backstory and his political influence, I thought would infuse and sort of be a backdrop to the Donald Trump relationship. But no, I didn't want to kind of, I didn't want to start there and then, you know, move on to Trump. I thought it would be more interesting to drop the audience into the middle of the, you just sort of start the movie and they can sort of catch up and over time learn as the movie progresses sort of who Roy Cohn is. You know, Roy Cohn kind of reveals himself in this movie you know, he was one of the most unethical, you know, people joked that he was a lawyer who hated the law. He was the most one of the most unethical people to ever work in public life in America. He was notorious for using blackmail and extortion to pressure people to do what he wants. He had the gossip column Page Six on his speed dial, and he would leak vicious rumors against people to the press to, you know, exert influence. So we sort of see these things playing out in real time, and it's sort of the audience gets to experience who Roy Cohn is through Donald Trump's eyes. And so I thought it would be more interesting rather than kind of having a windup where we see, you know, Trump, we're sorry, where we see Cohn, just sort of like, let's meet him and start to see him in action, and we can slowly fill in the blanks about who this man really is.
Yeah, and then when we meet Donald Trump, he's kind of a he's he is portrayed in the film as kind of a naif. He is not exactly ready for prime time, so to speak. And then kind of learns what were how did you what was your let's go back a step further here. When you were looking at the origins of Donald Trump and you're trying to figure out how to portray that, what were you reading? What were you looking at? What were you who were you talking to get a sense of Donald, early Donald Trump?
Yeah, no, I got a sort of to write this film, I sort of got a PhD in 1970s and 80s Trumpology. You know, I obviously read every single biography and long form article that has been written about Donald Trump and Roy Cohn over the years. You know, there's a famous profile of Cohn that ran in 1977 in Esquire magazine by Ken Auletta, the longtime journalist who now writes for The New Yorker. And so there's a very big body of work about both of these men. And then I did my own reporting, and I, you know, tracked down people who were friends with Cohn and Trump in the 80s. I interviewed employees of Cohn's law firm, Sachs, Bacon and Boland. And I sort of took all of that research and then fashioned it into a, you know, 2-hour narrative that covers this time period where from the time that Donald met Roy in 1973 to Cohn's death.
And there are some, you know, there's some pretty shocking moments in this. So you mentioned the blackmail and and that sort of stuff. There is a sequence in this film where we see Roy Cohn, you know, pull out essentially a big room of tapes and, you know, secrets, a room of secrets, and use those against one city council member in particular. I think the chairman of what I don't remember exactly, but he pulls it out. Is that something that was drawn? Is that creative license? Was that something that was drawn from history? What was where? When you're dealing with specific things like this, I know it can be tricky. How did you kind of balance that?
So the taping room is real. He had a stenographer who kind of lived and worked in his basement and tape recorded and recorded all of his calls. That's real. And his use of blackmail is real. Now, the specific incident that we dramatize in the film is creative license, but it's based on Roy Cohn's well-documented use of tape recording to get what he wants. And so I thought it was a really powerful way to sort of for Trump to learn how far people are willing to cross the line to get what they want. And Trump, it should be noted, has a history. There's been articles over the years that show that he, you know, has cameras all over Mar-a-Lago, that he's been, you know, alleged to have, you know, tape recorded phone conversations. So, you know, there is evidence that he took the lessons that Roy taught him in this regard. To me, that was like one of the most powerful scenes of the film. And when I wrote the script, there's, you know, this moment in the stage direction where I write about how, you know, Trump finally realizes who Roy is, and he's committing to this new master. To me, that's kind of the moment where Roy reveals himself truly to be the devil. And Trump faces a choice. Is he going to continue learning under this person's wing, or is he going to, cut him loose because he thinks he's beyond the pale? And obviously, we know that Trump continued to work with Cohn.
And when you're writing the dialogue for these characters, I know it's again, you're faced with this tricky situation where you've got a guy, you've got guys with records of statements. Like, you can, I think anybody here will recognize a Trump line when they hear one, right? Anyone who's listening to this, certainly. And then you have, and you've got Roy Cohn again, who's been around for a long, who was around for a long time, who was, has a long trail. But, you still have to write it. You still have to write a movie in a way that is entertaining, is able to tell a story. How do you, how were you, was there ever a moment where you felt yourself slipping too much into Trump speak or Cohn speak, or did you want to pull it back? How did you balance that?
Well, I think one thing that helped was that the arc of the movie traces how, Trump develops from a, the middle son of a middle class housing developer from the outer boroughs of New York to, a, prominent media celebrity businessman. So we want to see that progression. So at the beginning, the first third especially, but even the first half of the movie, Trump speaks, somewhat in recognizably, normal English. There's this very famous interview. I recommend anyone listening go watch it. It's on YouTube. You can find a clip, but it's the first televised interview that Trump did in 1980 with the TV personality Rona Barrett. And that interview really became a reference point for me to calibrate Trump's early voice, because when you watch this clip, he's very articulate. He's polite. He can put together complete sentences. He's charming even. And it's so different from the Trump that we see today, the kind of orange maniac that we see on our TVs. So that kind of became, that voice that he uses kind of became a reference point for the early Trump. And then as the film progresses, we see Sebastian Stan, who brilliantly plays Trump in the film, starts to develop more and more of Trump's speech patterns. And really by the end of the movie, he's almost, speaking in a way that, that we recognize from today. But I think for me, the real danger of this project is that it so easily could have become a 2-hour SNL sketch. And Trump is such a ubiquitous presence in our culture that it's very difficult to dramatize him in a way that feels real, like that you can suspend disbelief and watch, you can watch a character and actually get invested in the character. So I think my instinct was to dial it back wherever possible. And Sebastian's performance is very subtle. And I think people who've seen the film tell me that after the first 10 minutes, they forget that they're watching a movie about Donald Trump. They're just watching a movie about this character. I mean, he's named Donald Trump in the film, but Sebastian's performance is so fully lived in that it's not a parody. He's not doing an impersonation. So I think that was also the goal in the writing, is to try to just write something that felt real rather than just taking the greatest hits of Trump's vocabulary.
Yeah, and it definitely it's funny that you mentioned that early interview, because I watched that as well, and it is fascinating.
What do you think of it? What's your take on that interview?
Well, the one from the 1980s, It's like a different person. I mean, he's a different person, and it's fascinating to kind of look at that, and then even compare it to before he's running for president, when he's doing The Apprentice, and he has kind of fully accepted this idea of quote unquote Donald Trump, as opposed to it's like I don't know, it's like professional wrestling, right, where you have Vince McMahon, and then, the character Vince McMahon says he plays, right? Like, that's,
yeah.
And there's so much, I don't want to get into a whole thing about the WWE and Donald Trump, because that's another fascinating topic. But it is really interesting to see the early Donald Trump. And I think this movie does capture that pretty well, that early version of him before he changes. Did you work with Sebastian Stan as he was developing his performance here, as he was developing what sort of Trump he was doing?
Yeah, I mean, Sebastian has an amazing voice coach who he worked with to develop the character. So I wasn't in those sessions, but the way I did work with him, which was always it was so cool, is that we started working together in 2019, is when he got interested. He read the script and really got interested in the role, and it was about a year later that we actually started to move forward. And he would send me these voice memos of him practicing the voice as he was driving around Los Angeles. I always loved, like, I would ch check my phone, and every week or so there would be a new voice message from him, and I would listen, and I could sort of kind of hear him in real time over the next year or year and a half, kind of getting more and more into the voice and finding it. And I think what he does, which is so hard, and I'm not an actor, so it's hard for me to put this to words, but he captures the essence of a person rather than just copying that person. So his voice is not exactly like Donald Trump's voice, but it's the same spirit and in the same, neighborhood as his voice, that you just sort of s forget that you're watching an actor, and you just feel it's like this real person. And so I could hear that over the year or so that he was prepping for the role. The first ones were, not fully dialed in, and then by the end he was fully there.
And then you have Jeremy Strong, who I think has who has a little more leeway with audiences, because I don't think most audiences know what Roy Cohn sounds and looks like. But I do think I did read I read somewhere that Roger Stone had seen the movie and said that Roger Stone, who's in the movie actually, who I'd be curious to get what Roger Stone's take on Roger Stone in the movie. But Roger Stone said that the Jeremy Strong's performance as Roy Cohn was perfect. Like he sounded and looked and walked and talked exactly like him.
Yeah, no, that was Jeremy. I mean, obviously fans of the HBO series Succession know that Jeremy is kind of a once in a generation talent. He's an amazing actor. And he found a version of Roy that people say is so accurate. I mean, I think what I did with this character in the writing is, people ask me, how did you write a movie about Roy Cohn after Tony Kushner had, made Angels in America, which, featured, Roy so prominently and was played by Al Pacino in the film, sorry, the HBO adaptation of the play. And I think, it's both. I feel bad admitting this, but I think it did ha actually help me in the film. It was such a gap in my cultural education. I had not seen Angels in America and had not read Tony Kushner's play, so I didn't have that version of Roy at all in my head. So I just wrote the version that I felt represented the character after doing all the research and talking to people. And this version of Roy that Jeremy Strong plays is much more menacing, much more kind of contained, less voluble. I finally did, after I finished writing the script, several months later, there was a Angels in America revival on Broadway starring Nathan Lane. And I did go to see the play, and it's so brilliant. And Tony Kushner's version of Roy is very flamboyant, loud, gesticulating. And so it's fascinating that two writers can kind of have a different interpretation of this character. But I think Jeremy wanted to approach it as more that, so you feel the danger and the kind of exuding the menace that Roy had. Because people who do say that they've met Roy say that it was like you truly felt like you were in the presence of evil when you were around him.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar. The better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
Yeah, and I mean, look, there's also a difference between film and stage, right? You have, there's a, you, the camera captures different things than the stage projects.
Yeah. So, of course.
Were you on set while they were working? What was that process like? Because I know a lot of times directors aren't, you know, like, I don't know if I want the writer here. It can be tricky, but this is your project. You were on it from the beginning.
So I did spend a lot of time on set. We filmed, in Toronto for budget reasons. Filming in, New York City is just like prohibitively expensive unless you're a giant studio movie. So we shot in Toronto, and the production designer was like, I don't know how she did it, but we found slices of the city that did look like 1970s New York. So I went up there. I would say I was on set more than half the time. And then I could also watch in real time now. They didn't have this when I was, making the Showtime adaptation of my book, The Loudest Voice, which I wrote. I wrote the TV show for, so I had to be physically on set, but with this film, I could watch, the filming in real time on my laptop as if I was sitting on set and watching a monitor. So even when I wasn't there, I was, you know, basically watching as much as I could. And it was really kind of fascinating because there was these moments where Jeremy would text me like, hey, I need a line about like, Roy's going to give a speech at this cocktail party that he's hosting. It's kind of in the first half of the film. He's like, give me some lines about what Roy would say to introduce the party. And so like, I would like, you know, think and then furiously like text him back. And then I would watch it on the monitor, like 10 minutes later, him doing those lines. And so, I felt like I could give my input, as much as needed. But you know, obviously as a writer, you have to let go of your script at some point. I mean, it is a visual medium and it's an interpretive medium. And so our filmmaker, our director, Ali Abbasi, you know, had such a specific vision for this film that I never wanted to feel like I was getting in his way at all. So it was, you know, sort of finding a balance. But I think my philosophy was just, you know, provide input where it was asked for and then let my collaborators do their work.
Yeah, it's funny. You're the second person who's mentioned the kind of virtual camera village aspect of modern filmmaking. When was this? This was filmed post pandemic, right? This was 2021, 2022.
We started shooting in November of 2023, and we wrapped at the end of January of this year.
Okay.
So the other thing that's so remarkable about this film is we wrapped in January of 2024. And we cut the movie in 6 weeks to get it ready to submit for the Cannes Film Festival. And my friends who do work full time in show business say that like they've never heard of a feature film being edited in 6 weeks. But you know, I guess everything about this movie wasn't traditional.
Yeah, no, that's a crazy fast turnaround. I mean,
that's like closing a magazine story, basically.
Yeah, that's that's a issue of the Atlantic right there. That is wild. So you guys, you shoot, you write, you shoot, you wrap. That process takes almost 7 years. Then you submit to Cannes and it's off to the festival circuit. At which point, in theory, this is where the distribution offers come rolling in and everything kind of blows up. What happened with the plan for distribution for this movie kind of way? There's been a lot of talk of lawsuits and, you know, blah, blah. Fill folks in on what occurred between the premiere at Cannes and then till right now. I mean, where the movie's just hitting wide release or wider release this weekend.
I'll try to give the concise version. My friends joke that the fight to get this movie released is kind of a movie in and of itself. It's like, it can be like the, that, that show The Offer about the making of The Godfather. Yeah, so basically we premiered at the end of May at the Cannes Film Festival. It got a 8-minute standing ovation, glowing reviews from critics, and my producers and I really expected the night of the premiere to start getting offers from buyers, because movies that get really positive receptions at Cannes get offers from studios and streamers to acquire the films. And and we had, going into the festival, gotten a lot of interest, people at very, top studios. I don't want to single anyone out, so I'll just say, you can imagine that all the big players in Hollywood were telling us that they can't wait to see this film. It's the film that they were the most excited to see at Cannes. Cut to the, we're at the after party at the night of the screening, and, Trump's campaign issues the first legal threat, saying that they're going to sue. And then several days later, they're sending me and Ali Abbasi, the filmmaker, cease and desist letters. And what this did was, really put a chilling effect. I mean, my producers were telling me that not only, we didn't get offers the night of the screening, we didn't get offers, in the days after the screening, and we were starting to really get kind of the cold shoulder from the Hollywood community, who, went into this movie, kind of indicating to us that they wanted to, someone was going to acquire it. And, one by one, all the major players, ran away from it. And we started hearing things like that the companies were afraid that if they buy this movie and Trump would become president, that he would use the power of the government to go after their business. And, on the one hand, that's kind of terrifying and chilling that this is something that people talk about in America. Like, this is, having an authoritarian leader use a government to get the media in line sounds more like Putin's Russia than America. But Trump had demonstrated that he has done this. In 2018, he attempted to block the AT&T Time mm-hmm. Warner merger because right. Trump didn't like CNN's coverage, and CNN is owned by Time Warner. So everyone, all the major studios and streamers, formally passed on acquiring this film, which meant that the movie was lingering in total purgatory until we found a very small distributor called Briarcliff Entertainment, which is run by Tom Ortenberg, who inside the film world is a very well-respected executive. Throughout his career, he had distributed controversial political films like Fahrenheit 9/11, the Michael Moore documentary, Oliver Stone's film W, and the Academy Award-winning film Spotlight, about the investigation of the Catholic Church. So he's not scared of these kinds of stories. And he wanted to acquire the movie. But this is where, in a movie where, someone is fighting an enemy, but then suddenly they're also fighting someone inside their own camp. And that's like the real danger. We got into the standoff with our main financier, a production company called Kinematics, who gave us about $5 million to shoot the film. They didn't like this offer. They, in fact, didn't like the film. They thought that the sexual assault scene between Donald Trump and Ivana was too risky to put in the film. And as it happens, this production company is financed by the Republican billionaire Dan Snyder. His son-in-law, Mark Rappaport, had started this company and gotten money from his father-in-law. So we felt like we were not only being kind of abandoned by Hollywood, but now we had this production company with a tie to a major Trump figure that was preventing us from distributing the movie. So the movie languished in purgatory all summer. And I was just pulling my hair out because, it had taken us this long to get there. And the movie was done. The movie is good. And suddenly it just was considered too controversial. Anyways, the one thing people in Hollywood respect is money. And we were able to pull together investors to raise about $7 million to buy out Kinematics, the financier who gave up the movie. We got control of the movie and we signed the deal with Briarcliff so that the movie will be released in theaters this Friday, October 11th.
Yeah. It's in theaters. Well, this is going up Saturday, October 12th. So it's in theaters now. It's good. You can go. You can go watch it. Was there ever a worry on your guys' end that this was going to get, for lack of a better term, Batgirled, like disappeared into the? So you know, I use this term as shorthand, but to explain, Warner Brothers killed a completed production of the film Batgirl. Took a tax write off. There's a possibility something similar will happen with a movie that the Coyote versus Acme, which they have completed. And so when I say Batgirl, I mean basically get memory hold for financial, you know, purposes.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, that was the fear. And I thought I took, you know, solace. I was like, okay, this movie is going to be, you know, banned in America, censored in America, but it will be released around the world. And then I was told by my producers, like, actually know that the contracts, the distribution contracts that we signed, mandated that it first needed to screen in America before it could be screened overseas, which effectively meant that if we could not find an American buyer to put this movie in theaters or on a streamer, that we would, the movie would be memory hold because our foreign partners would not be able to air it as well. So there was a real danger that this movie was just going to be shelved and, you know, not seen. And I went to the Telluride Film Festival because, you know, we were planning to make the movie's North American premiere there at the end of August. And my wife and I flew to Telluride over Labor Day weekend, not even knowing if our movie was going to screen because the lawyers were still, you know, hashing out this deal to buy the movie back from Kinematics. And so I said to my wife, well, we're either going to go to the premiere of our movie or we're just going to go and spend a weekend seeing other great movies. And it was just surreal to have it that down to the wire. So anyways, a long way of answering your question of yes, there were many days where I thought this movie tragically was just going to be banned.
And that is, hey, look, it's funny. I do. There are occasions when people, you know, say things about Trump and I'm like, all right, calm down a little bit. But I do think that this is like the reaction to this film is perfectly indicative of what is actually the problem of a Donald Trump type figure. Right. You look at the AT&T Time Warner deal, his putting the thumb on the DOJ scale saying, let's try and block this. Like, that's bad. That's bad. That's not how things should work. And that is 100% something that happened here and needs to be, you know, addressed and pushed back against.
No, without question. I mean, this movie, you know, demonstrates that all it takes is sort of the threat of something to have a chilling effect on artistic freedom. And I was, you know, as painful as this whole thing was, I was, you know, taking some satisfaction in that Trump was just using the lessons that Roy Cohn taught him. In fact, all of the, you know, the attacks on this movie was just validating and was kind of making the case for why this movie should exist, because Trump was, you know, applying Roy Cohn's lessons to scare and intimidate people. And, you know, it was an eye-opening experience. You know, it was frustrating. And I think it's indicative of Hollywood is at this precarious moment right now. You know, post-pandemic, post-actor and writer strikes, and post-Netflix correction, you know, it's an industry that's on much more fragile footing. And as a consequence, you know, the studio executives really don't want to take any risks. Everyone's just trying to keep their job. And it's very easy to say no in Hollywood. The hardest thing in Hollywood is to get someone to say yes. And so, you know, Trump took advantage of that. And, but, you know, this is not an industry that is like the Hollywood of the 1970s that was, you know, major studios were making movies like All the President's Men, and, you know, politically active, films. And maybe this is a turning point and the industry will see that, you know, knock on wood, Briarcliff's going to make a lot of money selling a lot of tickets. And maybe they will see that, you know, political and controversial films are worth investing in. You know, the hardest thing, Sonny, to get these days is attention. You know, the rarest commodity in media is attention. And this movie had such a built-in marketing campaign because of the controversy. You know, that should be something that a studio should embrace. And it had the opposite effect. Yeah, as you said, this is something that needs to be called out, because no matter what your politics are, companies need to be free to, you know, make and disseminate the content that they want without fear of retribution from the government. I mean, in the same way that if the Obama White House had tried to censor, you know, Dinesh D'Souza's movie, or, you know, that would be equally appalling. This is not a partisan issue at all. Conservative, Republican, whatever your politics are, we should always champion free speech and artistic freedom. And you know, now that the movie's coming out, you know, it's sort of a happy ending, but it took a long time to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it really does. It really, I mean, the release of this movie is a fairly perfect reflection of the themes and lessons of the movie. So it is it's kind of a fascinating confluence of events here. All right. That was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. Do you think there's anything folks should know about the movie, or I don't know, Hollywood in general?
The main thing I'm hoping audiences can do, and I know this is hard because given, you know, Donald Trump is so polarizing, but I really want audiences to experience this as a film. It is an archetypal mentor protege story. It's also a gritty New York City movie. You know, when I was writing the film, I wasn't thinking about politics. Some of my reference points were like the classic, you know, New York films of the late 60s and 70s, like Midnight Cowboy, Serpico, French Connection, Dog Day Afternoon was another one. So, you know, this movie is a story about a time and a place and a relationship that would go on to change America. But, you know, whatever your politics are, I think you can get lost in the story, because it's entertaining. There's moments that it's like super fun, it's funny. And there's also moments that it's terrifying. But I guess my hope, and maybe it's naive, but my hope is that this film can be judged on its merits as a movie, and not just get overshadowed by the political conversation.
Yeah. Gabe, thanks for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And again, the name of the movie is The Apprentice. It's in theaters now. It should be playing anywhere near you. It is wide, so, or wide-ish. So it's out there. Check it out if you have some free time this weekend. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hey, Columbus, it's Bill and Jenny.
At Simple Bath & Kitchen, we're all about making your new bathroom or kitchen absolutely beautiful.
With our renovations, we can help you age in place comfortably while still enjoying a newly updated and modern bathroom or kitchen.
From grab bars to accessible showers, we know how to make your space safe and functional for years to come.
Because your home should adapt to you, not the other way around.
If you're ready to invest in your future comfort, come chat with us at Simple Bath & Kitchen.
Simple Bath & Kitchen, where our home is your home.
Oh my gosh.
Put your hands together for new Dr. Pepper Blackberry and Dr. Pepper Blackberry Zero Sugar.
There she is! Woo-hoo! Yeah! It's full Dr. Pepper!
With sweet blackberry flavor!
Dr. Pepper Blackberry, I'm obsessed with your succulent taste. Please marry me!
No! Marry me! Marry me or I'm gonna freak out!
Try new Dr. Pepper Blackberry.
It's a pepper